25. At 11:40 a.m. on the morning of Saturday, the 5th of August, Erin saw several police cars arrive at 84 Gibson Street. We never heard what she was thinking or feeling at this moment. It had taken me a while to cotton on to this frustrating aspect of a murder trial. I always want to know what's going on inside people's heads, but in court, unless a thought or feeling, for example, I loved Don and Gail, has a direct bearing on supporting the prosecution case or the defence rebuttal, the law considers it unnecessary baggage. Good for the movie adaptation, irrelevant to the fair application of justice. Faced with Erin's situation, however, unless you were a hardened criminal, you'd be shitting yourself, is my guess. It was probably embarrassing too, because Jack and Bronte were also home, witnessing the whole thing. We were shown a transcript of the initial conversation. "The reason we're here today is to execute a search warrant," Steve Eppingstall said. "Sure," replied Erin. "And it's in connection with the death of two people over the last couple of days." "Who died?" asked Erin. Surprisingly, she was genuinely in the dark. She hadn't asked anyone about any of her guests in intensive care at all. Hadn't crossed her mind, it seems. And guess what? No one had told her about either Heather or Gail's death either. For understandable reasons, it seemed the rest of the Patterson family were no longer talking to her. The video of Erin sitting at her dining room table and handing her phone over to Luke Farrell, footage you can easily find online, was the best opportunity we had to assess how Erin coped with this search. But that footage had been taken nearly 4 hours into the search, so it was long past the first moment of surprise, and Erin seemed outwardly calm. It wasn't hard, though, to detect some tension beneath the surface. Mind you, it was a tense moment for more than one reason. It was also the final move in a cunning game of deception that Erin had managed to pull off with extraordinary skill while she had five police officers in her house. And it's there, caught on tape. It wasn't your average police search, although much of it did follow standard procedure. The search warrant listed the categories of items that the police had the legal authority to seize, which in this case included food waste, particularly any mushrooms in the waste, food packaging, mobile phones, and digital devices capable of storing or communicating information. Steve Eppingstall was the informant in this investigation, meaning he would be the officer who would formally charge the accused if the investigation reached that point, and he would oversee assembling the brief and presenting it to court. His job was to stay with Erin throughout the search. The search itself was led by Luke Farrell, with David Martin Alcade in charge of photographing each item and video recording the search, while Meg Crawford recorded each item in an exhibit log. Simon Florence was also a member of the search team. In court, we were painstakingly taken through photos of all the items seized. This procession began with the contents of the bottom left drawer in the kitchen, which included an instruction manual for a Sunbeam Food Lab electronic dehydrator. When Erin saw that come out, she must have thought, "Oh, fuck." But the police gave nothing away. It was just one of many manuals in that drawer, and as far as Erin could tell in the moment, it meant nothing to them. They went through the pantry and the rest of the kitchen. Sitting on the bench was Erin's copy of Naji Maahashi's Recipe Tin Eats Dinner cookbook, which included Naji's now world-famous recipe for beef Wellington. It's probably locked away in an evidence box somewhere, but imagine if it ever came up for auction. You want to see a bidding war? Move over Leonardo da Vinci. Some cut fruit from the previous Saturday's lunch was still in the fridge, as was the leftover gravy. Sally Ann had asked her to keep these. And the police took careful note and several photographs of all the plates in the kitchen, some black, some white, some black and red, and the multicoloured one Bronte had made at school. Some were side plates and some were dinner plates, but no grey plates. There were no grey plates anywhere, nor was there an orangey-tan one. They took note of all Erin's books and all her appliances. They found and seized a black Kula Master computer and a couple of other computers and a spare Samsung mobile phone handset from Jack's room and an SD card from Jack's room and a Samsung tablet. But Erin also had two other Acer laptops in her study and bedroom that the police missed. Those laptops had even been photographed early in the search, then forgotten, despite the search warrant specifically saying that was what they were looking for. It appeared more than a bit sloppy. And, of course, Erin had two phones. Phone A, whether it was damaged or not, still carried the 783 SIM. It was Erin's main phone number, the one everyone knew about and the one she had continued to use right up until this point. But she also had phone B, which she had set up to be her new personal phone with her new number, the 835 SIM. In his evidence, Steve said his main job that day was to stay with Erin. Throughout the period of the search warrant, did you remain with the accused? Asked Nanette. For the majority of it, Steve confirmed. She was allowed to move around with a little bit of freedom, escorted, and there were times where I handed over, when she needed to use the bathroom, to a female member. There was also a period where Mrs. Patterson was allowed to use a mobile phone in a room, on her own, without observation as well. That had happened at around 2 p.m. when Erin had called a lawyer for advice. And that was a good 20 to 30 minutes on her own, and we stood outside the room while she was using her phone, said Steve. But not much about those 2 hours in the middle of the search was quite that simple. We knew from Erin's phone records, as plumbed and dissected by Matthew Sorrell, that Erin sent a text from phone A at 12:01 p.m. By general consensus, that was a text sorting out a lift for Bronte to get to ballet. At 1:45 p.m, however, someone tried to send a text to Erin, and the network couldn't find the phone. Sometime between 12:01 p.m. and 1:45 p.m, Erin had taken her 783 SIM out of phone A, and that number and that handset had disconnected from the network. In the world of innocent Erin, this phone had been damaged for at least 2 days, even though she'd kept using it. Yet the time she chose to take the SIM out and abandon the handset and switch to a new phone number was in the middle of a police search, and she did it secretly, without the police noticing, while she was being escorted around her own house. Why weren't you continuing to use 783? Colin asked her when she was giving her evidence in chief. Oh, because I wanted to change my number so Simon couldn't contact me anymore. And she wanted us to believe that's what was on her mind in the middle of a police search. But where was the evidence that Simon was still bothering her? He certainly hadn't bothered to tell her that Heather and Gail had died. Guilty or innocent, though, sometimes I just had to admit that Erin Patterson did have chutzpah. And, as if we needed more evidence of that, what the phone records revealed next is that at 1:20 p.m, just after she dumped phone A, Erin performed a factory reset of phone B while the police were with her, wiping off all the apps that she had installed on it only the day before. Erin had an explanation for that too. And why were you factory resetting it at that time? Quizzed Colin. I had put all my apps on it, including my Google account, which included my Google photos, and I knew that there were photos in there of mushrooms and the dehydrator, and I just panicked and didn't want them to see them. That I can believe. Her plan was already in place. When the police finally asked her to hand over the phone, which they were surely going to do before they left, phone B was going to be the one she gave them. There is a certain brilliance to all this. Then the police allowed her to call her lawyer. I've got a theory about the police in this instance. I don't know that any of it is true, but hear me out. During the trial, the cops just looked a bit clumsy. They had to concede that they had missed a couple of laptops. Oops, silly us. What else could they say? They tripped over each other, got lazy. As far as the evidence we heard went, that's what it looked like. It was a messy job. And maybe it was. Maybe. But I was looking at Steve Eppingstall, my man Stevie, and I didn't buy it. Mostly because of something I had learned during my first time sitting on a jury. 13, 14 years ago, or whenever it was, that was a drug matter, not a murder, but I remembered in that case that the police got the guy they were after because those cops pretended to be sloppy during their first search. But in fact, they weren't sloppy. They were actually damn fast, and they had put surveillance software on that dude's laptop and then missed taking it. Instead, they had left it there for him to keep using. Then they watched him incriminate himself even further. So when Steve stood up in our witness box and said that they had let Erin have her own space while she called her lawyer, I was thinking that maybe there was another reason Steve was guarding that door and making sure Erin didn't come out for 20 or 30 minutes. And it wasn't all about her fair right to call a lawyer. And when, in this case, Erin didn't do anything more to incriminate herself on either of her two Acer laptops, they weren't going to spill the beans to the world's media. They might want to do it again next time. These strategies don't always bear fruit, but even if they don't yield more evidence, the police don't have to say anything. They just have to put up with looking stupid for an hour or two. I could be wrong, of course. I've got nothing to prove I'm right. Betcha $100, though. But while the cops might have pulled a swifty on Erin with the missed laptops, Erin did the same to them with her phone. Which brings me back to the video footage of Erin handing her phone to Luke Farrell at the end of the search. That's phone B, with the 835 SIM, her new number. Later, she would try to justify the switcheroo by saying that at that particular moment, it was her phone. But she had used it, so far, a grand total of once to call her lawyer. And it had been factory reset only 2 hours previously, and the 783 SIM was in her pocket. If we were scoring the search, given that the cops had found the dehydrator manual, I'd put them ahead 2-1. But it had been a good game. With the search concluded, Steve, still playing escort, shepherded Erin back to his car. They drove down to Wonthaggi Police Station, where he conducted a formal record of interview under all the usual conditions. Her rights were explained. It was all video recorded. And the parts of the interview that were played to us in court are also now easy to find online. Steve began by bringing Erin up to date with the state of her four lunch guests, telling her again that Heather and Gail had died, and informing her that while Don had had a liver transplant, his condition was still extremely critical as of last report. Erin shook her head in a small display of shock and grief. Steve had less information on Ian and just said the diagnosis wasn't great for him either. "We're trying to understand what has made them so ill," Steve continued. Mumbled Erin. "Conversely, we're trying to understand why you're not that ill." "Okay, so you understand why we're interviewing you today?" "Yeah, I do," said Erin. "But I'm sure you understand too that, like, I've never been in a situation like this before. And I've been very, very helpful with the health department through the week, because I wanted to help that side of things as much as possible, because I do want to know what happened." Of course she had cooperated with the health department, or she'd sent them on a wild goose chase. Depends how you look at it. Steve acknowledged that she had also been very helpful to him and the search team at the house. A short digression followed when Steve wondered if there might be some ingredients from various Asian grocers in Erin's fridge at her Mount Waverley unit. But Erin said there wouldn't be. She'd cleaned it out. Then Steve swung the conversation back to more serious matters. Obviously, we've got concerns in relation to these mushrooms and where they've come from. Is that something you've done in the past? Foraging for mushrooms or anything like that? Never, Erin responded firmly. Never? Never, she repeated, even more firmly. All right. Do you preserve foods or anything like that? No. Have you ever dehydrated food or anything like that? No. Ironically, as Erin denied ever dehydrating food, her Sunbeam dehydrator was sitting on a desk in the very next room. It had been there all day. It was less than 10 minutes into the interview and Steve already knew he was talking to a liar. He moved on to the history of the lunch itself. Why had she asked those four people over? Because I've got no other family, Erin explained, sounding worried, lonely, and vulnerable. So they're the only support I've got left, and they've always been really good to me, and I want to maintain those relationships with them, in spite of what's happened with Simon. It sounded so credible, even if she was a liar. They talked through Erin's first appearance at Leongatha Hospital and her reason for only staying 5 minutes, then her couple of days at Monash Medical Centre. Steve said quite a bit about those two events. He had some questions about them, but also had rather a lot of information about them. He was letting Erin know that the police had already engaged in significant conversations with the medical personnel involved. He was telling her that they knew more about this whole thing than she might have thought they knew. He was giving her every chance to rethink her position in light of that knowledge. And having done that, he returned to the dehydrator. I just wanted to go through on tape some of the stuff, everything we've seized. Kitchen, far left bottom drawer, instruction manual for a Sunbeam Food Lab electronic dehydrator, just like the one in the room next door. What's that in relation to? Steve asked casually. Do you know anything about a dehydrator in your house or... No, Erin stated flatly. No? Okay. Do you own a dehydrator? How many chances could he give her? No, repeated Erin. No. All right, okay. I've got manuals for lots of stuff I've collected over the years. I've had all sorts of appliances and I just keep them all and... Yeah. Oh, okay, Steve said gently. He was just being curious, that's all. When did you own a dehydrator? I don't know, shrugged Erin. I might have had one years ago. Okay, what did you use that for? Like, when I first got the Thermomix, I got really excited about, like, making everything from scratch. And I did a lot of, you know, like, everything from scratch ingredients. And I did a lot of that. I could have had something like that. Steve moved on. If she wanted to go down swinging, that was her choice. He went back to the list of things they had seized from Erin's home. The fruit platter, gravy. He listed the computers and phones they had taken, including Erin's phone B with the 835 SIM. At that time, Steve genuinely thought that was Erin's main phone. Then they sorted out what had happened to the leftovers that the first two police officers had recovered while Erin was at Leongatha Hospital. The Ambos had been given that bag of leftovers to take to Monash Medical Centre when they took Erin. That was about it. They suspended the interview at 5:30 p.m. Steve might have won the search, only by a narrow margin, but he won the interview by a country mile. It would be some time before Erin realized just what a hole she had dug herself into. In the meantime, Steve packed up his car with all the tech they had seized. He dropped Erin home at Gibson Street before heading back to Homicide HQ in Melbourne. Steve immediately put Erin's phone B in the safe in his office. They thought it was going to give them so much. This was nearly the end of Erin's incriminating behaviour that the prosecution would use against her at the trial. Don Patterson died at 11:30 p.m. that night, Saturday, the 5th of August. Despite a liver transplant, his condition had kept relentlessly deteriorating. Ian had also been given every possible treatment the Austin had to offer, and he would slowly, oh so very slowly, improve. Later that night, Erin finally found an old Nokia handset. At 1:14 a.m., she dug the 783 SIM out of her pocket and put it into that handset. It connected back to the network. She later said she had suddenly realised that, for the kids' sake, she was better off staying in touch with Simon after all, so she had decided against changing her phone number. The Nokia handset was now her main phone. The phone A handset and everything on it which went missing at some point during the search would never be found. But Erin was obviously having trouble sleeping that night, and frankly, I don't blame her. Sometime before dawn, probably while lying in bed with her mind going over and over the events of the last 6 months, she initiated a Google search on her new Nokia to locate all her devices. And she could see that phone B was still connected to the internet. Wherever Steve had put it, he had not switched it off. So, just to make triple sure she'd covered every base, at 5:16 a.m., Erin factory reset phone B again, remotely, from her bedroom in Leongatha, even though it achieved nothing. In a timeline of all the evidence that constituted the Crown's case against Erin Patterson, that action by her was the last. It was early Sunday morning, the 6th of August, 2023. By the next day, Monday morning, her home was surrounded by media. They even came onto the property and filmed her after she drove home from Woolies. She parked in her driveway and tearfully answered a few quick questions. Then she headed inside, wearing her grey top, white pants, and sandals with socks. I remember watching the footage that night and thinking, the poor woman. The crime was over. The story of the crime was just beginning.